It's called the Vitter Motivation. Really have a sense of joy at having the opportunity we have to learn the Dharma, to practice it, and think of how many lifetimes, how many eons of rebirths we've had where there has not been this opportunity. And in our confusion, all we've done is run around looking for sense pleasure, helping our friends, harming our enemies, being born, getting sick, aging, dying over and over again. And yet, somehow we created so many amazing causes to have the present life. It's almost unbelievable that we have it. And so to have a strong determination to really make use of this opportunity. And to do so without being arrogant, that we have the opportunity without being full of disdain for people who don't use their opportunity, but rather with a mind that minds our own business and takes care of our own mind, instead of checking on what everybody else is doing and what we think they should be doing. But instead to check with our mind and see, are we cultivating the bodhicitta motivation when at all possible? Are we acting with kindness? Or are we rationalizing our misdeeds, like sudana, and in that way wasting our lives? So again, let's generate the bodhicitta and delve into the Dharma this evening. We have teachings every Thursday and Friday evening that are streamed. The Thursday night teachings, I thought we're in the middle of a text, and I thought that doing those with you you'd drop in for 2 weeks in the middle of something, and then that's it. And that didn't seem fitting with the program. But Friday evening, we're just starting this text. We did the first reading last week, and so this is the second one. So we're just in the preface right now. Okay, I was starting to read from the very beginning. I don't know if we really need to read the preface, but yeah, maybe it's good. It'll give you an idea of what's coming and will hopefully spark your interest. So this is approaching the Buddha's path is the first in what's going to be a series of I don't know how many books yet. In the series is called the Library of Wisdom and Compassion, and so it's His Holiness's kind of major Lamrim book, and I'm helping on it. This is volume one. It came out last year sometime, last August. Yeah, and then volume two, Foundation of Buddhist Practice, came out in May. Volume three, Samsara, Nirvana, and Buddha Nature, will come out in January. on volume 4. I don't have a title yet. So I'm going to ask you, you know, we'll have a contest and see who can come up with a really nice title. I'll tell you the contents of volume 4. It's Refuge, okay, and then the 3 higher trainings. Okay, so Refuge, higher trainings in ethical conduct, in concentration, and in wisdom. Okay, so one idea was the door to the Buddha Dharma, but we want more ideas, okay? And the winner wins something. I haven't decided what yet. Okay, but it'll be good. Yeah. It won't be having your new floor redone with cow dung, you know? Yeah, I know you're disappointed. We can use kitty dung. Okay, shall we read the book? Okay, so the first part of this book, I got quite a bit of feedback on it because I was telling a lot of stories about, you know, the people first encountering Tibetan Buddhism, the Westerners, and what a crazy kind of situation it was, where you have the most conservative element of Asia encountering the most liberal element of the West. Yeah. And then all the cultural differences that we had that we didn't even realize we had, and somehow, you know, working our way or not working our way through those. Okay. Some people seem to really like the stories. Okay, but now we're on the section that's an overview of the entire series. Okay, so we begin by laying the groundwork by the Buddha's teachings. So that is this volume and part of the volume 2. The need for pre-lamlim material is evinced in a comment His Holiness made when we began working on the series. Quote, "The Lamrim assumes that someone is already a practitioner with full faith in the Buddha. The main audience for the Lamrim texts in all the Tibetan traditions is someone who has already some knowledge of rebirth and karma, the three jewels, reliable cognizers and their objects, in other words, Buddhist epistemology, and so on." Okay. We need to add introductory material to this series so the students are properly prepared. Okay, so this is really true, you know, because we came along and you know, the Lama said, this is the synthesis, the Lama is the synthesis of the entire Buddha Dharma with all the important points, and all you need to do is learn it and you'll be fine, you know. And then it starts out with the, you know, the story of Lama Atisha, which is pretty amazing. You start getting the sea monsters there and all sorts of different things. And, you know, and then we go the first topic into how to rely on a spiritual teacher. And they start talking about seeing the Buddha, the guru, as the Buddha, and we're going, who in the world is the guru, and how do I know the Buddha believes the Buddha exists, and why should I see this guy as the Buddha, and what's the purpose of it, and this is all a bit weird. And then from there, we went into Precious Human Life, which starts out with the meditation, well, be so happy you aren't born in the hell realm. Be so happy you aren't born in the hungry ghost realm. Be so happy you're not born in the animal realm. Be so happy that you're not born as a long life god. And on and on. And it's like, we don't even know anything about rebirth. We don't know if we believe in rebirth or not. You know? And then we're meditating on this kind of thing. Yeah. And I just remember the first meditation course I did at Copan, and Marcel's up there, and you know, I'd be so happy you're not born in the hell realm. Wait a minute, Marsh, I wasn't born Catholic. I don't believe in the hell realm, you know. And then meanwhile, all the Catholics are like a little bit nervous, you know, because if I believe in Buddhism, I might go to Catholic hell. And if I believe in Catholicism, I might go to Buddhist hell. And, you know, how do I even know hell exists to start with? Yeah, so it was pretty interesting, you know. And then when they get into the section on refuge with all these qualities of the Buddha, and I remember Lama Pasang at that time, the second year I was working in the office, and he said, you know, I was registering people for the November course, and he said, you know, when these people come and they hear the qualities of the three jewels, they can't help but have faith. It's like, I didn't say anything to him, but, you know, that wasn't exactly what sparked faith in the mind of most Westerners who were there, you know, just trying to understand what life was about. And, you know, hearing that the Buddha, you know, has clear audience, and that when the Buddha spoke, everybody could hear a teaching in their own language, and you're supposed to see the guru as the Buddha, but when this guru was teaching, he couldn't even speak English properly, you know, so how am I supposed to even hear the teaching in my own language, you know? So it was pretty exciting. And then, of course, everybody's there. You know, the courses were mostly in the early days about the suffering of samsara and the eight worldly concerns. You know? And there we were, all of, you know, the kind of hippies decked out with our gulam beans and our Indian stuff and Nepali stuff and long hair, and the guys had beards, and you know, and where status was how many patches you had in your jeans, because our jeans didn't come ripped the way they do nowadays, and, you know, with a Calvin Klein label on them. You know, we got the jeans that like had no rips, and we had to wear them so that they got frayed, and then pick really cool colors to make the patches out of, and then that was a kind of status symbol, you know, as was, you know, how many places you've traveled and how long you've been traveling. Yeah, that was big status symbol. By that time, yeah, we had traveled for a year and a half, you know, gone back to the West and then come back to India. So we were on our second trip. Seasoned travelers, you know. Traveling from, we had traveled overland from Turkey, yeah, through Iran, Afghanistan, Pakistan, India to Nepal, you know, and that doesn't even include the European and North African part of our trip and other Middle East part of our trip. So we were like, so this is kind of the scene, you know. And, yeah, so you see why His Holiness was saying that, you know, people need pre-Lamrim work, you know. And especially since people were coming in with a lot of skepticism about organized religion, yeah. My generation really turned away from organized religion, just seeing it usually as quite corrupt and hypocritical. Don't you think? Yeah. So we weren't all ready to jump into another organized religion. Yeah. And so we needed all this kind of preparatory material, But of course, the lamas didn't recognize that. And so that's part of what we're trying to do here in particularly this volume and then half of the second volume. Okay. Also covered here are the meaning of faith, balancing faith and wisdom, seeking out a qualified spiritual mentor, relying on that person properly, and developing the qualities of a receptive student. These will help you to approach the Dharma as a 21st century Buddhist, which we talked about last week. Then we set the foundation for learning and meditating by explaining how to structure a meditation session on the Lamrim. After again reflecting on the possibility that the continuity of our mind stream does not end at death, but will take another body in another life, we look at the precious opportunity our present human life offers us and how to set our priorities. So you see, the whole discussion of rebirth needs to come at the beginning. Yeah. You know, from our studies with Geshe Thapke last week, you know, it became really evident in going through the text how crucial understanding rebirth is for understanding what the three jewels are and understanding the path. This leads us to reflect on the eight worldly concerns, ways in which we get distracted from making our lives meaningful, and karma, and their karma and its effects. For the first step to having a meaningful life is to abandon harming others. In this way, we will know the causes for happiness and the causes of suffering, so we can go about creating the former and abandoning the latter. The topic of karma is vast and of great interest to many people, so that is covered in depth. And so here, instead of karma, instead of death, refuge, and karma, we moved refuge later and brought karma coming after death. Because in the West, most people, you know, when you hear about death and you're coming to have some feeling for rebirth, then it's like, okay, what determines where I get born? And so the issue of karma is foremost. The Tibetans like to teach refuge first, because they say that if you have faith in the Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, then it's easier for you to accept the scriptural authority, which is what you have to rely on to learn about karma. But for Westerners, the refuge section is actually quite difficult. Yeah, and so that's why refuge in this series doesn't come until volume 4. Okay, so karma came much earlier here. Then we proceed to explore the four truths of the Aryas. Aryas being those beings who directly realize the ultimate mode of existence. These four form the basic framework of the Buddha's teachings. The first two truths, true dukkha and true origins, lay out our present unsatisfactory situation in cyclic existence and its causes, the afflictions that torment our minds and lie behind our suffering. We look at the 12 links of dependent origination, the process by which afflictions and polluted karma propel our rebirth and cyclic existence, and the way we can free ourselves from it. This section delves into the psychology behind wrong views and disturbing emotions. Okay, so that's material that's all covered in volume 3, where we talk about true dukkha and the true causes of dukkha. Okay, now, at this point, and also in volume 3, we started going into nirvana and a little bit about the true path, so true cessations, you know, in volume 3. Now, at this point, we realize that we need the guidance of the three jewels, the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, who will teach us and show us the path to liberation through the example of their lives. Okay? So it's when you're when you understand the four truths, yeah, then you really see you need some guidance, that you don't know what the path is yourself. Yeah. And so that's when you seek out the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. And so in Pramanavartika, we didn't get to it this time, but later in chapter two, huge, long discussion about the 16 aspects of the Four Truths. Yeah. And we study those there in order to see that that's the principal teaching the Buddha explained, and he explained it through his own personal experience. And so it goes again to confirm that the Buddha is a reliable guide. Okay. Also, when we talk about the four truths, the last two truths, true cessation and true path, those are the Dharma refuge. Yeah. So it makes sense to talk about the objects of refuge when you're talking about the four truths, because two of the truths are the Dharma refuge. Okay. I was thinking, you know, when Josh last week, their translation of the refuge in bodhicitta prayer, take refuge in the Buddha, the teachings, and the assembly. Saying the teachings isn't quite accurate, okay? Because when we talk about the Dharma, there's the transmitted Dharma and the realized Dharma. So the transmitted Dharma are the scriptures. Those are the teachings. Yeah, but that's not the Sangha jewel, okay? The Sangha jewel is the true cessations and the true paths. Dharma jewel, sorry. Yeah, good, I'm glad you're listening. So the Dharma jewel is the true cessations and true paths. Because when we actualize those in our mind stream, then we become the Dharma refuge. Yeah. And before we become the Dharma refuge, we rely on those who have those realizations in their mind streams. So when we take refuge in the Dharma jewel, it's not the scriptural teachings, the transmitted teachings. It's the true path and true cessations. At this point, we realize we need the guidance of the three jewels who will show us the path. Learning about the potential of our mind, the possibility to attain liberation, and our Buddha nature increases our confidence that we can succeed in freeing ourselves from samsara and attain nirvana, a state of genuine peace. So this is explained in the latter two of the four truths, true cessations and true paths, the state of liberation and the method leading to it. Included in true paths are the three higher trainings, okay? Because when we talk about, you know, what's the true path, then what's common to all the Buddhist teachings are the three higher trainings. Yeah, so the higher training in ethical conduct, in concentration, in wisdom, that's volume four. And so that includes the four establishments of mindfulness, the 37 aids to awakening, and all sorts of other juicy topics. Okay? So these are topics that are oriented towards practice in both daily life and meditation sessions. And so in volume four, there's a beautiful two chapters on the four establishments of mindfulness, which are a totally fantastic practice that is very often skimmed over in the Tibetan tradition. People usually jump into emptiness and then Tantra. But when His Holiness really took the time and we went through the explanation of the four establishments of mindfulness, and he was saying that he thinks it would be, you know, he wishes that it was more practiced in the Tibetan tradition. And in my experience too, in dealing with Westerners coming to the path, I think it's much better to start with the four establishments of mindfulness, where you're getting in touch with what you are instead of immediately jumping into Tantra and starting to visualize yourself as something that you're not before you really understand what you are. Okay. And also because when you look at Tantra, you know, okay, in the three higher trainings, the establishment of mindfulness of the body is looking at this blood and flesh and bones body for what it really is. In Tantra, it's visualizing yourself as the deity. That's the mindfulness of the body. So there's parallels between the two, but we really kind of have to understand what this is already before we start visualizing all sorts of other things. Yeah. So through these practices, we will calm our daily behavior, deepen our concentration, and gain wisdom, thus beginning to actualize our great potential. But freeing ourselves alone is limited, considering that others suffer just as we do, and they have been amazingly kind to us. To free ourselves from the prison of self-centeredness, we learn how to cultivate immeasurable love, compassion, joy, and equanimity, as well as bodhicitta, the intention to attain full awakening in order to most effectively benefit all sentient beings. Then we learn how to train in the perfections, practices that enable us to bring our bodhicitta motivation to fruition by practicing generosity, ethical contact, fortitude, joyous effort, meditative stability, and wisdom. Imagine the kind of person you will become when these wonderful qualities have become second nature to you. So that's the material that's going to be in volume 5 that I have yet to begin. And what's really interesting in that volume is to learn about the four immeasurables as they're taught in the Pali tradition and to see the similarities between the Pali tradition and the Sanskrit tradition in the four immeasurables, to also look at the Pali tradition and their description of what a Buddha is, what bodhicitta is, and what the paramitas are, because they also have 10 paramis in the Pali tradition that many people don't even know about, okay? But there is a bodhisattva path laid out, and it is really beautiful to study that. Yeah, it's quite inspiring, especially when you have a background in the Sanskrit tradition beforehand. Having generated the altruistic intention to attain full awakening, we now want to cultivate the wisdom realizing the nature of reality, the only counterforce that will completely and irreversibly eradicate all afflictions and their latencies from our mind stream. So working on the method side of the path, you know, generating renunciation, bodhicitta, all the practices to accumulate merit, by themselves alone, these things will not bring liberation or awakening. We have to realize the ultimate nature of reality, the wisdom side of the path. And we have to realize the deepest level of selflessness in order to eradicate all the obscurations on our mind. So that's going to be a few volumes, okay? Here we learn the tenets of the various Buddhist philosophical systems, which have diverse views about the ultimate truth. Just give me the one right version of it. Sorry. Our job is to sort through them with the aid of the past sages and discern the most accurate view, that of the Prasangika Madhyamaka tenet system. This leads us to discuss the true truths, the veiled and ultimate truths. So veiled truths, this is what we're using instead of concealed truths or conventional, yeah. Here I said veiled truths. It needs an ED on the end, veiled truths. Because here anyway, in the printed book I have, So veiled truths are objects that appear true to a mind affected by ignorance. And ultimate truth is their actual mode of existence, their emptiness. After further reflection, we come to see the uniqueness of the Prasangika Madhyamaka view of emptiness, as well as how to unite the concentrated mind of serenity, shamatha, and the analytical mind of insight, vipassana, to realize the ultimate nature. Here we will also touch on the view of selflessness as understood in the Pali and Chinese traditions. And that's really interesting, you know, because as I explained before, His Holiness was quite clear he didn't want this to be another Lam Rim book with the rehashing of what is usually covered. He wanted new material brought from the other Buddhist traditions to be incorporated. The Buddha also set out the paths and stages the practitioners traverse to attain their particular goals, liberation from samsara or the full awakening of Buddhahood. Learning these gives us a roadmap to follow our spiritual journey, and we come to understand the various qualities and realizations that are developed on the paths. They also enable us to check our meditative experiences with the generally accepted sequence of development. And so this is going into the paths and stages, yeah, or what they call salam, and very, very helpful, I think, for people to learn that. Just gives you a, you know, it gives you a roadmap of where you want to go and what are the signposts as you're going there. Then I put in here, then we learn about the Pure Land practice found in both the Tibetan and Chinese traditions. And this leads us to a discussion of Vajrayana, which is a branch of the general Mahayana. The work concludes with an epilogue from His Holiness containing personal advice for his students. So actually, I've later decided to take the part about the Amitabha practice out of this series, because His Holiness isn't real. He's not keen on people thinking, well, I'll just be born in a pure land and that's a safe situation. He wants people to really practice. And so I thought, okay, let's take that out, make that a whole other volume in itself, talking about the pure land practices. Also, the Akshobhya, what's this Pure Land called? Abhiramati? Anyway, Akshobhya's Pure Land. And so, you know, talking about those things in more depth and in just a different book. Okay, so this work is designed not simply to give you information about Buddhism, but to enrich your Dharma practice. Okay? So it's not just for information, it's for practice. To this end, most chapters contain summaries of the main points so that you can easily remember and reflect on them. So there's a lot of reflections in the volumes. Please take advantage of these to deepen your practice by contemplating what you read. The work would have become too long had reflections been inserted for every section. So where they are missing, please review what you read and write out the main points for contemplation. This will help you to apply what you learn to your own experience and integrate the Dharma in your life. Okay, so then it's going through just more about how the book came into existence. I don't think we need to read that. And the abbreviations, which I don't think we need to read. Okay, so we're moving on. We're going to be at page 3 now. Okay. Didn't we have an introduction from His Holiness, or is this it? Oh, we read His Holiness's introduction already. Okay, that was it. Okay, so now we're on chapter 1, which is called Exploring Buddhism. A spiritual path is essential to human life. Think about that for a while. And how many people are completely disconnected from their spiritual side. Although advances in medicine, science, and technology have done much to improve the quality of human life, they have not been able to free us from all suffering and bring us secure and lasting happiness. In fact, in many cases, they have brought new problems that we did not face in the past, such as environmental pollution and the threat of nuclear war. Therefore, external improvements in our world are not sufficient to bring the happiness and peace that we all desire. For this, internal transformation through spiritual development is essential. For this transformation to occur, we need to follow a spiritual path. Those holiness right here is saying it at the beginning. Okay? Spiritual practice involves transforming our mind. Although our body is important, satisfying it does not bring lasting happiness. But you know, when our body's uncomfortable, we think only if my stomach ache went away, only if I had more food, only if my, you know, the wasps would leave me alone, only if the ticks would stop biting, you know, then I'd be okay. You know, we fuss so much about this body, and yet our body doesn't bring us lasting peace. Yeah. If you look, you know, the body's constantly uncomfortable, isn't it? You know, let's all rub our knees and stretch and wiggle and, you know, try another shape meditation cushion because this meditation cushion just isn't the right one. And then we try a chair, but the chair doesn't fit us exactly. And, you know, okay, so satisfying the body does not bring lasting happiness. We must look inside ourselves, examining our attitudes and emotions, to understand how profoundly they influence and shape our experience. The Buddha comments, and this is in the Pali Canon, the world is led by mind and drawn along by mind. All phenomena are controlled by one phenomenon, mind. Okay. The mind includes not only our intellect, but all of our cognitions, emotions, and other mental factors. The Sanskrit word for mind, citta, can also be translated as heart, which is quite interesting, because in the West, mind, heart, brick wall. You know, mind is up here, all its conceptualization, intellectualization. Heart is in here. And the two, you know, are really disconnected. That's kind of the Western view. And, you know, in Buddhism, it's the same word that you can translate as mind or heart. You know, you can say somebody has a good mind and somebody has a good heart. And it's, you know, virtually the same words. The Sanskrit word for mind, citta, can also be translated as heart. It refers to all of our consciousnesses, sensory and mental, and to the variety of mental states we experience. By subduing the afflicted aspects of our mind, our experience of the world is transformed. Whereas, if we seek to change only the external environment and the people in it, we continually meet with frustration and disappointment, because we cannot control the external world. It is only by developing the great potential of our mind-heart that we will be able to find a way out of our suffering and to truly benefit others as well. Okay, so this is one of the basic tenets of Buddhism, you know, that it's our mind that's the source of our happiness and our misery. And you know, when we first meet the Dharma, we go, yeah, that makes so much sense. And we start practicing like that and trying to transform our mind. And then somebody does something that we don't like and it's their fault. Yeah? We're sure it's their fault. I'm just sweet me. That person is harming me. It's all coming from outside. Yeah, stop that person from doing what they're doing, and I'll be happy. You know, and what makes me happy? Well, that comes from outside too. I want praise and approval. I want a good reputation. I want sense pleasure. I want money and possessions. Yeah, I want all those things because they really give meaning and purpose and everything to my lives. Yeah, that's what I want. That's the path to happiness. You know, and that's exactly what our family taught us and what society teaches us, because that's all they know. Yeah. And so in our society, the whole internal aspect is really ignored. And we ourselves, while we understand that the mind is the source of our experience, you know, on a day-to-day basis, we have so much habit energy with it's all coming from outside, and I just have to change outside. What do you think? What's that? Your life? Yeah? The grass is greener on the other side of the fence. The chanting is better in the other monastery. Yeah? So we're always battling with the external world to rearrange our duckies. By the way, where did all of our duckies go? I hope somebody put them, they're in there? Okay, very good. We don't want to lose our duckies. Yeah, because we need them for all of our future retreats. Maybe some of you have probably noticed the duckies. You see a ducky on our dining room tables from time to time? You haven't seen our duckies. Oh, goodness, go pull out a ducky for him. Okay? The duckies, yeah, there's a story behind our duckies. I don't know in Holland, but in our country, when you're a little kid and you take a bath, there are little rubber duckies that they put in your bathtub. Do you have them? Yeah? So when you're a kid, you're always trying to line up your duckies. Yeah. So here are some illustrations. We have a pink ducky who's reading a book. Lam Rim Chenmo. Oh, I'm sorry. He's reading Approaching the Buddhist Path. Very good. And then this is the ducky who is at the beach with his t-shirt wearing, you know, with sunglasses on it. Okay. Here's our other ducky. He looks a little bit sad, this ducky. Yeah. We have another ducky with a smiling face. So we got all these duckies because we always talk about how in our lives we're trying to control the outer world and line up all our duckies like we did when we were kids in the bathtub. And how we never succeed. And so then one day this package arrives and somebody sent us all 50 duckies. So, you know, here are some of our duckies. Yeah. Here's Donald Ducky. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. But Donald Ducky. Okay, we saw the smiling one. This one has chicken pox. Okay. Cow dung? What? So what is he?
A cheetah duck.
Okay. So he doesn't have chicken pox. We have a froggy. And here's another one. This one has little horns. Is it
like of the fawn. A cow? You think it's a cow? A cow duck? Anyway, so, you know, we line our duckies up. Donald Ducky has to be in the center. So our duckies. So we're always trying to control the world, you know? Okay, so my mother's supposed to do this, and my father this, and my sister, and my brother, and my friends are doing this. Yeah, this is, who's this? This, this is the president. This is Donald Duck. Donald Duck should be doing this. Okay, and Cheetah Duck, and Cow Duck. Okay, so we want to control everybody, you know? And we think once we succeed in doing that, then we will be happy. And so most of our life, we are trying to control our duckies and line them up. And you get them lined up, and then somebody comes along and boosts them. Or the duckies won't cooperate and they won't go in the line. This one says, what kind of ordination order is this? I don't belong here. You put me third. I'm first. Yeah. And then this one says, no, I got ordained before you. And then Froggy Duck says, look, you guys, I'm the one. I have the higher ordination than all of you. Okay? And there we go. Okay? So, story of our lives, isn't it? And then we have to get away for our duckies. Where we don't have an elephant ducky. We should have the four friends. What is it? The elephant? The bird, the rabbit, and the monkey. Okay. Yeah, so we still need some duckies. Oh, yeah, we can't get them into the country now. There's tariffs. Oh. We better, Donald, you better do something. We need our duckies. He's cross-eyed. Okay. Yeah. So, you know, we know this, and yet we're always outer referenced. Yeah. In Buddhism, therefore, the obstacles we aim to eliminate are not external, but are afflictive mental states, distorted attitudes, and disturbing emotions. The tools we use to counteract them are also mental. Compassion, wisdom, and other realistic and beneficial attitudes and emotions that we consciously cultivate. They aren't going to come by praying. We have to consciously cultivate them. The Buddha's teachings, or Buddha Dharma, what is commonly known as Buddhism, helps us to differentiate realistic and beneficial attitudes, views, and emotions that accord with the way things are. The teachings also give us instructions regarding what to practice and what to abandon on the spiritual path. The Buddha taught from his own experience, and we are free to accept or reject his teachings using valid reasons as well as our own experience as criteria. So His Holiness is really encouraging us to learn and think and try things out and see from our own experience if they work. Okay, the next section is the purpose of existence and the meaning of life. So the Buddha said, this is in the Majjhima Nikaya, for the most part, beings have this wish, desire, and longing. If only unwished for, undesired, disagreeable things would diminish, and wished for, desired, agreeable things would increase. Yet although beings have this wish, desire, and longing, unwished for, undesired, disagreeable things increase for them, and wished for, desired, agreeable things diminish. So in short, we all want happiness, we don't want suffering, but what happens is the suffering comes uninvited, and the stuff, the good things we want, don't come when we're looking on the outside. Yeah, and this is, you know, we see this very clearly through our own experience, don't we? Yeah, hello out there. Don't you see this in your own experience? This is, yeah. What the Buddha said above is confirmed by our own experience. Oh, imagine that, the next line. All of us want happiness and no one wants misery. Yet despite our sincere wish, the opposite comes about. I believe the meaning and purpose of our life has to do with eradicating the causes of pain and increasing the causes of happiness, so that this deepest wish in the heart of each and every living being can be fulfilled. I do not know of an overarching purpose for the existence of this world, and from the Buddha's viewpoint, there is not a clear explanation. We simply say that the existence of the world is due to causes and conditions, to nature. The existence of the universe is a fact. How existence came into being and the possibility of ending suffering are quite different issues. We do not need to know how the world began in order to stop our suffering. Okay. And that's really true. And you can really see in the West, people are so preoccupied with the origin of the universe. You know, the beginning of the Bible is about that. So much of scientific, research is about that. And yet here His Holiness is saying, it's not important because that's an entirely different thing than how to end suffering. Everyone wants to be happy and peaceful and to avoid suffering. Even a person who doesn't know the purpose for the existence of the universe doesn't want to suffer. Such a person would never think, because there is no plan or big purpose, I will let myself suffer. Our body exists and feelings of happiness and unhappiness exist. Whether our intellect understands the reason for our existence or not, we are concerned about the happiness of ourselves and others. By seeking to bring about this happiness, we give purpose and meaning to our lives. The purpose of our life is happiness and peace, an internal feeling of well-being. To bring that about, we need material development and proper education. We also need spiritual development. By spirituality, I do not mean religious belief or rituals. For me, spirituality refers to the basic good qualities of human beings, such as compassion, affection, gentleness, and humility. When these qualities are well established in our hearts, we will have more peace of mind and will contribute to the happiness of others. Someone can be happy without religious beliefs, but not without these basic good qualities. So he's really, you know, has a very different understanding of what religion and spirituality means. Yeah, because so much in society, religion and spirituality has to do with belonging to a religious institution and saying that you adhere to certain tenets or certain creeds of that religion. And people derive some feeling of security by saying, I am a, fill in the blank, and I believe in, copy it out of the catechism for that religion. And His Holiness is saying, that's not it. Yeah, what's really it is these qualities that we have as human beings automatically, and to enhance them, enrich them, and bring them forth and show them in our lives. And whether, you know, we don't have to, like, say, I am a card-carrying Buddhist, I am a this, I am a that. You know, what we have to do is develop our own good qualities. And that's spirituality, that's religion. Quite different, isn't it? You know, when you look nowadays, yeah, religion has become, you know, adherence to an institution. It's become so politicized. You know, if you belong to a certain church and your pastor or priest or whoever is teaching X, Y, and Z, you know, there's this kind of feeling that, you know, you better follow those, you know, that's the political position that you should follow as a good whatever it is. Yeah? And that's not religion. That's politics. Yeah? And it really makes me very sad to see how much religion, religious institutions have gotten involved in politics. Getting involved in societal issues, I think, is important because as, you know, people with religious or spiritual beliefs, with ethical concern, bringing an ethical purpose to different issues like the death penalty and so on. That's one thing. But telling people who to vote for, yeah, is a totally different ballgame, and I don't think that belongs in a church. And actually, the Johnson Amendment, I think that's what it is, prohibits that in the U.S., but the current administration wants to change that so that churches can, because right now, churches, and we're considered a church by the IRS, cannot do political activities such as advocate certain candidates, you know. And the present administration wants to change that. But I think that completely degenerates what the real meaning of religion is. Okay, sentient beings, all beings with minds that are not fully awakened, experience two types of happiness and suffering. Physical happiness and suffering, which occur at the level of our senses, and mental or emotional happiness and suffering, which occur at the mental level. As human beings, we are not different from animals, insects, and other beings with bodies. We are all basically the same in terms of seeking physical comfort and avoiding pain. But in terms of mental and emotional happiness and suffering, we human beings are very different from other species. We have human intelligence and thus have more capacity to think, remember, explain, and examine. For example, unlike animals, human beings may suffer mentally when they remember injustices their ancestors experienced. You know, you're not even alive, but you think about what your ancestors experienced. You can get quite emotional, very upset. Yeah. I wonder if we ask Mudita, you know, what... if you all met Mudita or Upeka, you know, what their parents went through in their lives. Yeah? I wonder if they have any remembrance of their mom. I don't even know if their dads were around. I wonder if grown cats remember their parents or not. Who knows? Yeah? But they certainly aren't going to get disturbed by thinking about, you know, my mother was out on the street eating you know, leftover buns behind the bakery. You know, they don't have that kind of memory at all. I wonder how much they would even remember it about themselves. Okay. We may speculate about the future and become anxious or furious about situations that haven't occurred yet. Right? Yeah, we project into the future, we can get so upset, so full of anxiety. Due to our imagination, we are more sensitive on a mental level and experience so much joy and misery that is created by our mind. Because mental suffering is created by the conceptions in our mind, countermeasures that are likewise mental are important. Towards this end, human beings have developed various religions, philosophies, psychological theories, and scientific hypotheses. Okay, and there's a section about, this is an interesting section, yeah. A middle way between theistic religions and scientific reductionism. The more than 7 billion human beings on our planet can be divided into three general groups. Those who are not interested in religion, those who believe and practice a religion, and those who are actively hostile to religion. The first group, those who are not interested in religion, is the largest. These people are concerned principally with their day-to-day lives, especially with financial security and material prosperity. Among this group, there are two types. The first consists of people who have ethical principles and use them to guide their lives. The second values money, prestige, and pleasure above all else. Those guided by ethical principles are, in general, happier. Those who lack ethical restraint may gain more temporary benefit, but in the end, they do not feel good inside themselves about what they have done. Afraid that their devious means will be found out, they lack genuine self-confidence and inner peace. Many of our global problems are due to such a lack of ethical principles, which comes about when people do not know or care about the moral consequences of their actions. Without such knowledge and the restraint it produces, greed has free rein. We can see that many of our global problems would be solved if people lived with a sense of responsibility that comes from valuing ethical principles. Isn't that true? Yeah. You know, when we were teenagers, we may have had an attitude towards ethical principles. You know, this is just stuff they teach you in Sunday school. Do this, don't do that. Oh, so many rules. This is all ridiculous. Yeah. But when you get older and you start looking at society and the things that go on and how suffering is produced in this world, then it's so clear that so much of it comes due to a lack of ethical conduct. Yeah? Through just basic ethical conduct. Yeah? And lacking that, then, you know, people are killing each other, they're ripping things off from each other, they're sleeping around, they're lying, you know, harsh words, divisive speech, gossip, the whole nine yards, you know, coveting, malice, wrong views. And this is, you know, what runs the world. If sometimes I sit there and I just feel like I'm living in a nut house. You know, sometimes it just feels, okay, this is the world, I understand it, and this is how it operates. And sometimes it's like, I'm living in a crazy place. You know, it's totally crazy what is going on with, you know, the total lack of just basic ethical conduct, you know, and the total lack of manners. And it really is, and how people don't see it and keep doing the same thing again and again.
It's like,
where am I? How in the world did I get here, you know? I don't know about you, but after 9/11, you know, everybody's so shaken up. And I was sitting there thinking, okay, you know, Osama bin Laden and his group of people have a problem with, you know, the Americans and a certain group of people. But I don't want to be in the middle of their quarrel. I have no desire to be involved in any of this. And yet, I have no choice. Yeah, I'm living in this planet at this time, and you get yanked into involvement in this kind of stuff, whether you like it or not. I was thinking of people in mainland China during the Cultural Revolution, because if you ever study about that, it's like the whole country went crazy, totally crazy. Yeah. During the Cultural Revolution. And I can imagine many people living there going, I don't want to be involved in this. It's too crazy. I want nothing to do with any of it. And yet, there you are, living in that country, and you can't get out. Yeah? So it's an interesting thing, isn't it? Yeah? Being stuck in the middle of situations that we really don't want to have anything at all to do with. You know, even in a family that's full of dysfunction, you know, you could sit there as a kid and go, you know, I really don't want to be involved in any of this. And yet there you are. Huh? So this is why Dharma practice is very important for us, because that's what's going to give us the tools to deal with all of this. Okay. Of the other two groups, those who sincerely believe in a religion and practice it, and those who are hostile to religion, the former also uses ethical principles and compassion to guide their lives, while the latter intentionally opposes religious ideas. Some people in the latter group say religion is the instrument through which the ruling class exploits others. Others say that religion is just superstition or a cause of ignorance. And I can understand both of those positions. Yeah, I held them at one time in my life. And if you study history, you know, religion is the instrument through which the ruling class exploits others. True. Okay. Religion is just superstition or a cause of ignorance. When you see how many people use it, true. People in these three groups are the same in that they all seek happiness. There is no difference among them in this regard. The difference occurs in terms of what each group believes will lead to happiness. Okay. So how each group defines the causes of happiness. Second of the truths. Except for those in the first group who privilege ethical values above personal gain, the rest trust principally in money and material comfort. The second group affirms that happiness comes primarily through ethical conduct as well as religious and spiritual practice. And the third group believes not only that happiness lies in the material world, but also that religious ideas are irrelevant, make-believe, and counter to human happiness. Of these three groups, Buddhist practitioners belong to the second. Okay. So that's the one that says happiness comes primarily through ethical conduct as well as religious and spiritual practice. From one perspective, Buddhism is a religion and a spiritual discipline. Because Buddhist principles and meditation are directly linked to mental training, it is also a science of mind. From another viewpoint, since Buddhism does not accept an external creator, it is not a theistic religion, but a philosophy. Depending on how we look at Buddhism, we may describe it as a religion, a science of mind, or a philosophy. We do not need to say it is one and not the others, for Buddhism embraces all of these three. We also see radical materialists who deny the existence of mind as an immaterial phenomenon, as well as religious believers who assert an external creator. We see people who stress logical reasoning and others who emphasize uncritical faith. It seems that Buddhism does not fit in any of these categories. In contrast to religions that oppose critical investigation, Buddhism emphasizes that we should be skeptical, even of the Buddha's words. We have to investigate whether scriptural passages are reliable and true or not. If we find contradictory evidence, including scientific findings, we should follow what can be proven rather than what the Buddha said. Wow! The Buddha himself stated that his followers should not accept his teaching out of respect, but after investigation and personal experiment. We also have the liberty to examine and test the Buddha's teachings. So that's something quite important and very unusual amongst religions in the world. Yeah, most religions do not encourage that kind of analysis and investigation and testing it for yourself. On the other hand, while Buddhism shares respect for logic and experimental proof, it does not deny the value of having faith and confidence in spiritually realized beings. Since our five senses are limited in what they are capable of knowing, scientific tools are not amenable to investigating many extant phenomena. So it seems that Buddhism is in between science and theistic religions. It likes the investigation and analysis, but it also doesn't discount the value of faith and confidence in spiritual beings who can guide us. In the future, perhaps Buddhism may become a bridge between religion and science, bringing the two closer together. I think that's already happening. I have met many times with people of other faiths as well as with scientists. Sometimes my Buddhist explanations have helped my Christian brothers and sisters practice their own faith. Other times, scientists in the fields of cosmology, biology, physics, and modern psychology have found common points between Buddhism and their disciplines. Some of these scientists began our meetings thinking, this will be a waste of time because Buddhism is a religion and religion doesn't have much in common with science. But after a few sessions, they were eager to learn about the Buddhist concepts of subtle particles or our explanation of the relationship between the mind and the brain. This demonstrates the possibility of mutual understanding with practitioners of other religions and with scientists. So I think we'll stop here. Questions, comments?
I'm not going to articulate it so well right now, but I just have this aspiration that this whole library of books eventually is, you know, part of the grade 12 curriculum, at least this volume. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, it's like listening to a kind, wise person alleviate your fear and, you know, point to what is this unlimited potential. And, you know, I'm sure kids in grade 12 right now around the planet are feeling different levels of despair and, you know, fear and you know, wondering what the future will bring, and here it is. Mm-hmm. Here's what's going to lead you out of that those kinds of mental states.
Yeah.
You know? So that's an aspiration.
Oh, to be honest, Venerable, when I first read Guided Meditations on the Stages of the Path, and I saw you had moved the How to Rely on a Spiritual Mentor to the back and put in other like pre-Lamrim topics, at first I was quite shocked, like, oh, you can reorganize the Lamrim? You know,
who is
this,
dare you? No,
who is this person
this
anyway?
This is heretical.
Yeah, some part of me was like, but really over time I see the tremendous wisdom of that, and I think it's... it seems to me that, you know, some of the organizations that have had scandal in the recent years, especially in Chinese Buddhism, were teaching the Lamrim and misunderstood this idea of how to rely on a spiritual mentor. So it's just so terribly misunderstood and misused.
Yeah.
That it's so profoundly important to have that grounding in a Buddhist worldview. And to put that last, actually, I think it makes tremendous, it's very, very wise.
Yeah.
So I'm coming to really appreciate that.
Yeah. And this was something that I really had to think a lot about in this series because, yeah, in one way it makes much more sense to put the whole thing about the spiritual mentor at the end. However, you know, I was seeing also that there's a tremendous need for people to hear His Holiness's perspective on this issue also at the beginning. And in this world now, because there's so much confusion about it. And so that's why I, at the end, decided to put it into volume two. You know, but in my mind, I was including it there as part of the introductory material, you know, not part of the actual Lamrim stages. And I did it simply because it's so misunderstood in the West and really the source of a lot of confusion. But, you know, another part of me said, yeah, much better put it at the end. But it will be many years before we get to the end. Yeah, and it needs, you know, because when some of the things happened with, you know, yeah, the Rigpa and with Shambhala, then it's like I could refer people to the book. You know, this is what His Holiness says. And His Holiness is so practical. You know, that's what I love about him. Is he's so down to earth.
I was wondering when they, in the Pali canon or even commentaries or even tradition more generally, when they talk about the paramis, do they divide it at all into like the bodhisattva path and solitary realizer path and hearer path?
Oh, yeah. The idea of the three vehicles is something totally different than the paramis or the paramitas. But all of the talk about the three paths of, you know, the hearer, solitary realizer, and bodhisattva. Was that your question or...?
They have the three paths.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering if the paramis are different for the different paths.
Oh.
I mean, like, it seems like...
They talk about the paramis as the bodhisattva path. Yeah. So in the Pali tradition, when they set out the 10 paramis, they're the, you know, talked about as the bodhisattva path. However, just like the paramitas in the Sanskrit tradition are the bodhisattva path, but that doesn't mean that the hearers and solitary realizers don't do those same practices. They may do it with a different motivation. Okay, but all the traditions, for example, all the vehicles teach about generosity, ethical conduct, wisdom, concentration, okay? So it's called paramis because it's done with your bodhicitta motivation. But those practices themselves are practiced by everybody, okay? Yeah. And what's a little bit confusing sometimes when they're listed as paramitas is... And you're taught in Lamrim, you practice everything one by one.
But then generosity is way at the end of the path, you know, and ethical conduct's way at the end of the path, but then they also come in the long rim earlier, and so you get confused, that, you know. Or people think, oh, fortitude's way in the bodhisattva practice, so I don't have to practice it until after I generate bodhicitta. Wrong. You know, we need to practice fortitude right from the get-go. Okay? It's just when these things are done with the bodhicitta motivation, then they become the paramitas.
So, like Venerable Damcho about the order of the topics. Mm-hmm. I was really interested to hear tonight about refuge going after karma.
Mm-hmm.
And you explained that for the dependents, they put refuge first because they think it's really important to establish kind of like faith in the words of the Buddha so yeah. that you can then digest karma, so uh-huh. to speak. And so I'm interested to hear your perspective for a Westerner in terms of getting the teachings on karma without that foundation of, you know, having faith in the word of the Buddha, because it is such a tough topic and a hidden phenomenon. And so how?
It's a hidden phenomena, but not all of karma is extremely hidden, okay? And the thing is that karma makes sense. Yeah, we may not be able to put forth a syllogism that is watertight, but just to our rudimentary sense of cause and effect, yeah, if you're mean to people, they're going to be mean back. Yeah, and if you give to people, they'll give you things back. So it in that sense it makes sense, okay. And I think I think the more difficult thing with Westerners is not the quote logic of karma, what brings what result, although some people have some difficulties with those things. But I think what is more difficult for Westerners is the idea that our actions have an ethical dimension. Yeah, because most people who are not religious in our society nowadays have the idea, you know, you just do what you want, and yes, there's cause and result, but the result comes right after you create the cause. Or at most it comes in this life. You know, maybe later on, they arrest you for a crime, you know, 30 years later. But, you know, they don't really feel like their actions have an ethical dimension that will ripen on them. And I think that's the tough point for people to really get. Yeah? Does that answer your question okay? You can bring it up again.
Comment on that. When we did our SAFE courses, originally we had refuge earlier on, and it was the one course I actually was the facilitator. And these were long-term practitioners, most of them, and it was tough. The topics are so much harder, I think, for Westerners. We put that course much, much later now. And we put all the karma ones first. And I feel like the topics are so much easier that you cover in karma because we're steeped in causality and that kind of view here, and it's very tangible day-to-day life. But then when you do the topics that come up in refuge, you know, like the kinds of body of a Buddha, and all those things, I mean, like, it's out there for a lot of Westerners. And I actually found also that it would be helpful if we had a little more proper training in what refuge is, because the other thing that's really struck me about that group of people was most of them had the attitude of, I went to a ceremony one day and took refuge, and that was the beginning and the end of it. And they were kind of shocked about how the breadth and the depth of what refuge entailed. And so I felt also that, you know, more learning about how refuge changes over the course of your life and what it really means, taking a safe direction, or you know what you're turning to. That didn't also wasn't there for most of the people. There were about 10 people in that group, and all of them were like, oh, it was just kind of something I did one day, and I thought that was the end of it. Mm-hmm. And that's like...
Yeah. Yeah, because I think the topic of refuge requires much more just belief. Yeah, because unless you really have a sense of what the mind is and the potential of the mind and how cause and effect works in the mind, then, you know, the qualities of the Buddha seem, like you said, really out there. Like, huh? You know, my mind and the Buddha's mind, my mind can become like that? You know, they didn't teach me that in school. Whereas karma, you know, there's some kind of logic to karma, isn't there? Yeah? And then just also because, you know, when they get into specifying the 10 paths of non-virtue, okay, Westerners, you know, there's a few of the 10 that they just go ballistic over. But it makes them start looking at their own behavior and why they do what they do. And that's really valuable because most of us, you know, we just impulse enters the mind, words come out of the mouth, impulse enters, we do what we do. You know, so learning about karma makes people go, oh, you know, I've gotten involved in all 10 of those. Yeah, how did that happen? And so it gets people to think about their own behavior and be more introspective in that way, which I think is really, really helpful. And then people also get in touch with what they don't feel very good about having done. And then they begin to understand when we talk about purification, why purification is important. You know, because we've all done stuff we don't feel good about. And secular society, you know, if there's stuff you don't feel good about having done in secular society, what's the technique for dealing with it? Drinking and drugging. Yeah? And so, you know, that's what most people do. And then here people come to Buddhism and say, okay, I don't feel good about what I've done. And there's something else besides drinking and drugging that is actually going to work and make me feel better about myself.
While we're still on the topic of karma, this morning Venpo Losong helped me articulate that I am more believing in the idea that anger causes virtuous karma to be corrupted than I am that purification causes non-virtuous karma to be purified.
Huh.
Yeah, that's interesting to chew.
Yeah. On. Yeah. And that's the way of thinking of that keeps your mind stuck. But if you can see one, try and see the other too, huh? And next week we'll go into Buddha Dharma and other religions. What I think is so skillful when His Holiness talks about science, you know. If you look at the whole way he talked about it, he didn't go, oh, these scientific people who believe in reductionism, they're so ridiculous, you know. He just said, oh, here's one aspect where we agree with science, and here's one aspect where we agree with religion, you know. And so it was like he didn't take sides and he didn't criticize anybody, and yet he was able to articulate the Buddha's position on this. Yeah. Quite skillful.